I'm very excited tonight to continue our journey. Tonight we'll make a turn into the third chapter of 1 John. And as you see, my subtitle is Out of This World. I'd like to think that that's what you'll think after you hear this lesson, like, wow, that was out of this world. But that's not really what I'm going for. I have been very impressed in my spirit lately of the love of the Father. That is not a new thing. That is a revolving thing, I think, that every believer goes through repeatedly. You came to that, I think, for the first time when you accepted Christ. Something about the fact that God loved you enough to die, to become a man and die for you, raised from the dead. That was a love that gave you a revelation, made you want to live for Jesus, whatever iteration that looked like. And then we kind of go through peaks and valleys. At least this has been my experience. You'll have moments where you struggle. You'll have moments when maybe even you doubt. Doubt is not a bad thing, by the way. Doubt is the best friend of faith. Don't fight against doubt. Stand against unbelief. Unbelief and doubt are not the same thing. Doubt is what causes you to have a faith that matters, because you took faith serious enough to confront your doubts. Unbelief has no room with faith. I'm not talking about unbelief. I'm talking about going through some doubts. You go through some doubts and you wonder a little bit and you struggle a little bit. And the revelation of faith seems to roll down that roller coaster to the bottom tunnel. And you're wondering, I don't know if I'm the right man for the job, for whatever the job is. I don't know what he thinks of me. I don't know how I feel about him. I don't know if I love his children or my enemies. Maybe I'm the only one that's ever went through those searches, but I have went through my share of them. And then you have moments where the roller coaster takes that long ride upward and your heart swells and everything is laid out panoramic in front of you, and you go on this amazing ride around the next curve and the loop, because you're over the hill, man. You just fall in love with him all over again. You know he's all in love with you again, and you just swim in that love. And don't be discouraged if you're in one of those lulls where you're struggling with the love of the Father, or you're struggling with your own doubts and your own faith. It's okay. He's in this for the long haul. He's not outside the cart saying, when you get to a next crescendo, I'll be there. No, He's with us. And so I've been on a turn lately. I've been went up a hill, saw the horizon out in front of me, of being re-impressed, if that's a word, with the love of the Father, and swimming in the implications of what it means for him to love me the way that he loves me. A sermon that will air this coming Sunday across all of our platforms is a message called First Love. A message I did recently in Missouri that deals with that topic, love. And one of the texts that I use near the end of that sermon is the text that will be the body of our work tonight from 1 John 3. And so it's evidenced in that fact that I've got another sermon coming up that's right a slice out of this thought, that this is where I've been. So to arrive at this point was serendipitous, but not lucky. It was just the Father bringing me a wave of revelation about his love that sort of meets the moment and the moment we arrive in this text. With all of that said, I don't want to open in 1 John 3. I actually want to open in Matthew 8 in a story that seems to have absolutely nothing to do with the love of the Father. But I'm going to do a comparative Greek word study for you tonight out of the gate that I think will set us up for a better understanding of a very common idea, the very common idea that God loves you. Okay, I say common because to Christians, that's common. It's an uncommon love, which we're going to find. But I want to try to add some traction to that. Now, there is a moment where Jesus gets in a boat. He goes across the sea with his disciples. And while he's going across the sea, he takes a nap. And a storm rages on the Sea of Galilee, and the disciples find themselves in the middle of a storm. Now, remembering that most of the men on this boat, at least half of the men on this boat, are professional fishermen. They've spent their lives on the water, and yet they're in the middle of a storm so great, like this storm that's rolling in right now. Man, was that on cue. They're in the middle of a storm so great that they are afraid. which is hard to believe if you're a professional fisherman, that you surely have encountered something to this extremity before. So I think the message being sent to us in that text is, this is overwhelming. And what happens when you're overwhelmed? You turn to Jesus, and that's what they do as well. Now, watch the text, and then we're going to work on some of the Greek context. Matthew 8, 25, 26, 27, I jump in to the middle of the story. His disciples came to him and woke him, saying, Lord, save us, we are perishing. But he said to them, why are you fearful, O you of little faith? Then he arose and rebuked the winds and the sea, and there was a great calm. So the men marveled, saying, who can this be, that even the winds and the sea obey him? In that 27th verse, please indulge me. We're not in 1 John, I know, and we're not trying to jump back and cover Matthew, but I want you to see something that's going to be relevant tonight for 1 John. I want you to see two things from verse 27. The men marveled, and the very phrase marveled is a verb usage of the word marvelous, and that which is overwhelming, that which is amazing, something we've never seen before. And then the author takes it to the next level and uses a phrase, the men marveled and said, who can this be? And in the English, it just appears to be a sentence that's a question, like, who's this guy? And they know him, and they know his name, and they know where he's from. But if you couple who can this be with marveled, then this is what you find. Who can this be is the Greek word potepos, which is from what country and of what sort? It's a Greek word that is used to describe that which is hard to describe. Some translators use the word marvelous. That's why I coupled it with marveled in Matthew 8, because the disciples marvel at what they just watched Jesus do. What does he do? He calms a storm basically with the snap of his fingers. This man speaks to weather patterns, and they respond to him. And the response the disciples give is potepos, a Greek word that means, what did I just see? What I just saw is something that can't be explained in the natural. If you watched a man stand in front of this storm and say to it, stop, and immediately the sky went sunny and all the clouds dissipated, you might say, you probably wouldn't say potepos because that wouldn't make much sense, but you might say, where's this guy from? Who's this guy? I can't describe what I just saw. It's only used actually about a half a dozen times in the New Testament. A couple of those are pretty popular. One of them is the way Mary feels towards Gabriel. When Gabriel comes to her and says, you're going to bear a son, and he is going to save his people, and you're going to call his name Jesus. And the Greek phrase that is used to describe what she thinks is potepos. She says, where's this from? And she's not wrong. This is from another dimension. Let's just walk through the wall. So notice the power of potepos. Where is this from? Who is this? And what's the answer? It's an angel. So literally, where is it from? It's not from here. And then the disciples, it's used in the book of Mark when they're walking into the temple. And it must be a beautiful day. The sun is shining. Archaeologists say that on the fresco of the side of Herod's temple, they had brushed gold specks into the waves. They had brushed it as if it were waves of the ocean, and the gold would dance when the sun would come over the horizon and make it look as if the water on the side of the temple was splashing. And there's a moment in the book of Mark where his disciples walk in and go, what manner of stones are these? And then Jesus says to them, I say to you that not one stone is going to be left unturned. Well, their question is potepos. This is out of this world art. We've never seen anything like this. How is this possible? What does this have to do with us? 1 John 3:1. Behold, what manner of love the Father has bestowed on us, that we should be called children of God. Therefore, the world does not know us because it did not know him. Behold, potepos, love that the Father has bestowed upon us. A phrase that means, hey, the love that the Father has for us, out of this world, man. Inexplicable. The same word the disciples would use to describe Jesus in that boat. Where's this guy from? A guy that can look at a storm and snap his fingers and the storm dissipate? This guy's not normal. This guy's not like the other guys we've met. The same thought Mary has. Who's this angel? What is this? Where is this from? And John uses that word. I think this is impressive to me. John uses that word to say, hey, you want to know how much the Father loves you? It's the kind of love that's out of this world. It is an inexplicable love. It is, as one translator says, it is marvelous love. Because that's the only word we have in the English that even comes remotely close is marvelous. And even that word doesn't quite cut it. Something that makes me marvel. The fact that he loves us this much. What manner, I like to say, from what country, from what place is this? Where did this come from? And when I explore that thought, it leaves me wanting. It's beyond me to say his love is out of this world, but it leaves me wanting an adjective and a way to describe it. And it's the problem that I ran into with the message you'll see this weekend with first love, where Paul in the book of Ephesians says, I bow my knee to the God of creation, and I pray that you know the height and the width and the depth and the length of the love that he has for you, and that you be filled with the fullness of God. And every time I try to wrestle and contend with the height and the width and the length and the depth, I'm in over my head. I'm completely incapable of swimming to the bottom of that love and really finding the right words to say how much he loves you. And I found that no matter what I do, I can't make his love high enough. I can't make it deep enough or wide enough or long enough. I run out of adjectives and I run out of capacity and I run out of ability to tell you how loved you are. This is the message of the Bible. This is really what the Father wants for you to see and to know. He has never wanted you to feel alone. He has never wanted you to feel abandoned. I like how when I'm making these podcasts, we're in Genesis on the daily podcast, I like how they infiltrate these lessons, and they're not supposed to. I mean, why should we be in Genesis 3 in 1 John 3? But as you can imagine, we are, because I'm thinking all the time along those lines. So I was doing a podcast today, and I got God. He talked to the snake, and then he talked to the woman, and then he talked to the man, and then Adam turns and names Eve, Eve. Her name means life or living, and he doesn't name her what he could have named her based on what she just did. Well, that was a sermon exploding in me right there. It's called name her where she's going, not where she's come from. So he doesn't name her liar or cheater or sneak or deceived or deceiver. He names her life. He gives her the name Eve. Her name never appears until after she falls. And it was as if the Holy Spirit spoke to me and said, it's because I don't remind you of what you've done. I remind you of what you could do. I remind you of where you're going, not where you've come from. And that was exciting. And I had a blast doing that. And so then the next verse was the next podcast. And lo and behold, right after Adam names Eve, what happens next is God takes animals and makes skins and covers Adam. And now Adam, who had his eyes open to his nakedness, has his eyes closed to his nakedness and open to the covering. And here's God in the most unheralded act of love and mercy. This is why I'm bringing this up tonight, because it was another moment today where I went, okay, well, maybe if I share that, I'm a little closer to plumbing the depths of God's love. Unheralded moment for God. God doesn't get enough credit for this. In the book, in Genesis, God takes an animal and takes its skins and puts it on Adam. And we got lost in that and thought that what God was showing Adam is how to offer an animal sacrifice. There's no indication in that verse that God's trying to show Adam how to offer a sacrifice. What there is that God is showing Adam that even when you fail, even when you are naked and exposed and guilty, I got your back. I cover you when you can't cover you. And the sacrificial system is not for me, because I can look at you naked. I saw you naked before you knew you were naked. You've always been this. You just didn't know it. The sacrificial system is not for me. The sacrificial system is for you, Adam. It's for you because you're the one that needs the animal skins, not me. I'm fine without animal skins, but I don't want you looking at your failure anymore. What's that an example of? Mercy, grace, long-suffering. I'll tell you what's an example. Love. Man, it's a father looking at his son who's exposed to the elements of this system and did it to himself, brought it on himself, and says, you know what, I love you too much to leave you like this. I'm going to clothe you over. And then you know, my preacher brain starts turning, because then I got a pig-smelling prodigal son running down the road to come back home in the book of Luke. He smells like the hogs he's been slopping, wearing rags, wasted his money on riotous living. And what happens in Luke is the dad grabs hold of him and hugs him and puts shoes on his feet and a ring on his finger and puts a robe on his back. He clothes the naked because, man, he loves you. So this is why I keep saying to you, be honest with God. Be completely exposed before God. Why would you not? Come before God with no pretense. Don't hide anything from Him. Be completely exposed before the Father in truth, because then He gets to clothe you over with what He knows you need. And maybe you need some compassion, and maybe you need some attention, and maybe you need the oil and the wine. And maybe you just need a good meal of fatted calf. And maybe you need the feather bed. But whatever it is you need, your Father knows it. But it doesn't work until we're honest. It doesn't work until we expose whatever it is that we've been hiding and we've been covering up. And that's a shoddy job at trying to get to the bottom of His love. But it's just one more example of how loved you are and how out of this world that love is. So I will say this. If you've yet to see the love of the Father as, and this is my phrase, out of this world, higher than all other understandings of love, then I say you're selling His love short of its potential. So if you don't see the love of the Father as greater than whatever comparative style of love, I'm going to throw some comparative styles of love at you, okay? And let's just do an experiment, because 1 John 3 gives us permission. What manner of love is this? What potapos, what country is this from? Man, where'd this love come from? I haven't seen this kind of love in people. So you'll see things out of people and you'll go, man, that looks like the love of God. And that's a compliment, but it still sells the love of God short. Because no matter what you're seeing out of people, His is potapos, His is out of this world. His is beyond comprehension. And yet that's what makes it so deep that we can't plumb it. You know, we just keep swimming in it. We just keep trying to discover it. I like to say this about Jesus too, and I'll go back to that because I do want to throw some examples of love out there. And then we're just going to try to let Him trump them, because He will. But I like to say that about Jesus too. I mean, if the version of Jesus that you're seeing isn't out of this world, then you've shortchanged Jesus. I mean, He's out of this world. What you see in Jesus, you're not going to see in anyone else. He loves like no other. He forgives like no other. He's long-suffering like no other. He's compassionate like no other. And that doesn't take away the fact that He lives in us and that we brim over with potential spiritually. But He's out of this world. And when you see Him, He's out of this world. So what kind of love are we talking about? I mean, that's my statement. It's not Bible. But if you have yet to see the love of the Father as out of this world, then that's higher than the other understandings of love, then I think you're selling love short of its potential. What I mean by that is that whenever you look at versions of love in the system of this world, you'll see some amazing examples, but His love is always greater. Think about passion, a word we call lust. And most of the time, we actually try to differentiate that between lust and love. We go, well, that's not love, that's lust. Let's assume for a moment that there is no real difference, that lust is just a really shallow form of love, because I kind of tend to think that maybe it is. And the reason I say that is because lust is the love that is oftentimes filled with emotions and passions that don't necessarily run deep, but they do definitely run hot. And so they are certainly something that are real, even if you want to mock the love. Well, that's just puppy love. That's just like. That's just lust. Okay, maybe so, but it's still very emotionally real to the person that's going through it. And therefore, it's a love that they're paying attention to. Yet our Father's love is out of this world in comparison to what we would call lust or passions or a shallow love. Even though sometimes the only way we have relayed the love of God is through lust and passions and through emotions. Have you noticed that we have to go deeper in the love of God than just landing in an emotional state? A lot of us got saved in an emotional state. We felt something at that salvation. Maybe we didn't, but for the most part, people sort of rally around some sort of emotion. But like a love that goes past lust and into real passion or real romance, it has roots that go down deep so that it's not just about what you feel, but it's about what you know. And then that love doesn't have to feel anymore. It just knows, right? I'm describing the difference between dating and marrying, the difference between sex and a relationship. Not that relationship doesn't have sex, but you know what I'm talking about. The difference in a passion and the difference in something that's rooted deeply. And what's the difference? Time spent, but also the amount of your heart given. So it's not just your body that you're giving or your time that you're giving, but it's something deeper, something far more passionate. Books are written on this. Movies are made about this. Tickles our emotion. It speaks to us about passion and lust. And yet, His love is out of this world in comparison to that. And runs so much deeper than just how I feel. Thank God it runs deeper than how I feel. Because I don't always feel love in walking with Him. I don't know. Sometimes maybe I expose too much. Maybe I say too much of stuff like that. You're up teaching and you're up preaching. You're not supposed to admit those kind of things. You're supposed to make people think that you got it figured out. And if they'll stick around in the Q&A, you'll help them figure it out. But the reality is that I don't always feel the love that I have for Him and that I know He has for me. But His love is out of this world. I can only wrap my mind around it in terms of I've went beyond lust and passion and into a rooted love where I don't have to feel the same emotions I felt. Natasha and I just celebrated 26 years last Thursday of marriage. And so the love that we have at 26 years is not like the love that we had at 1 year. But that's not unusual. That's love that grows. It goes past needing and goes into giving. It's not just about what you can get out of something, but what you contribute to something. And it's more than just what you feel, but what you know. And yet, I'm still not even close to describing His love. Why? Because it's out of this world. And I say all of that because I want you to move past the feeling that you have to, that love with the Father has to be an emotional thing. You have to feel it every day, because you don't. In fact, don't cheapen the love of God with having to feel it every day. Let me get a little blunt with it, all right? His love is out of this world for you. It doesn't rely on you to emotionally respond, no more than you need God to emotionally tickle you, make you cry, make you shout, make you feel, make you laugh, give you goosebumps. Now, I've come up through cultures of the church where we didn't think we had church unless there was crying or shouting or goosebumps or running around the building or people falling out on the floor, because we relegated the power of God and the passion of God to the emotion of man. And so that was how we equated it. And what I have found is that if we're not careful, we can make love as we have it with the Father such an emotional transaction that we'll start to cut deals with God for how God will bless us in return. And while we often call that performance-based religion, I think in some ways what we're doing is asking God for an emotional response in response to what we do. And I don't think He's a slot machine. And I also think that the love that He has for us is so far beyond the way that we've comprehended love that we need to reevaluate our love relationship with the Father. If you're getting your needs met socially through the systems of this world. It's the one playing with your emotions. It's the one giving you what you're looking for. And then we come to God as some sort of spiritual slot machine on Sunday, or when we read our Bible, or when we pray and have Him do the spiritual side. In a way, we're sort of treating God like a pornographer. I know it's a blunt illustration, but we're waiting on the emotional climax with God while we flirt with everything else all of the time. Allow God's love to give me the emotional tickle, but I sell myself out to the systems of everything else. His love's out of this world, man. That's a cheap way to walk in the love of the Father, is to wait on the emotional tickle that He can give me. Does His love move us emotionally? Sometimes beyond words. Sometimes to tears. But that doesn't make His love less when we don't feel that. I know it sounds real ABC, real elementary what I'm saying to you, and I just really wish I had known this when I was a lot younger. Like, you know what? God loves you, Paul. He's pleased with you. He's satisfied with you. He's really happy to hang out with you. And you don't have to emotionally respond to it. You don't have to feel goosebumps up and down your neck. You don't have to have a certain song playing to think that the Father's excited, or be in a certain church setting to think that the Father's excited. Just relax in His love. Because you know what? When you really love someone and someone really loves you, you don't even have to talk in the same room with them. And that's a little bit like the love of our Father. Just relax in His love. Just let Him wash you over with the love that He has. There's a love that's loyalty. Kind of like foxhole love. Someone you've nearly died with, you have a loyalty to them that is a love that's beyond anything else you share for anyone else. But the love of the Father's out of this world. Even beyond that. There's a love you have that's ownership. You take pride in the stuff you own. Your car, your home, your dog. And love is too big of a word? Eh, maybe, but probably not. Because people truly love the stuff that belongs to them. But the love of the Father? Out of this world. None of that kind of love taps into it. There's parental love. This one gets as close as I think we can get. Because in 1 John 3:1 he says, "What manner of love has the Father bestowed upon us that we get to be called the children of God?" In other words, it's an out of this world love that is only even closely, even remotely understood whenever you look at maybe your own kids or your own grandkids and you go, "That's part of me and I love it and I can't explain it and I'll die for it if I have to," because that's a love that's out of this world, and that's getting very, very close. And so I knew coming into today, it's an uphill battle. I can't describe an out of this world love. So what do? Just go, "It's out of this world. Let's move on." No, you got to give it a shot. You got to try. You got to throw something up there and see if it sticks, because you never know what kind of love somebody holds up to be the number one love. And if you can get this sliver of a revelation tonight, you or whomever watches or listens, just a little bit of the revelation that the love is beyond my ability to comprehend it, then you'll get started on the next crest of that roller coaster of going, "I'm experiencing a revelation of the love of God. I'm understanding the love of God. It's independent of how I feel. It's independent of what scriptures I have or what I'm quoting or what's going on in my life. It's not just lust. It's not just a passion. It's beyond all of that. It's out of this world. It's bigger than I could ever understand." He said in that text that the love of the Father is beyond comprehension in that we get to be called the sons of God. John 1:12. This is the same writer, but this is our gospel of John. I remember we were there years ago, back when we were in John chapter 1, but I wanted to bring this back tonight because this is such an important verse in relation to our verse. "As many as received Him..." John's writing this past tense. He's looking back on the biography of Jesus. He's looking back on the life. And he says, "As many as received Him, to them He gave the right to become children of God, to those who believe in his name. The phrase right there is authority. As many as received him, he gave them the authority to become children of God. Who were born not of blood, not of the will of the flesh, not of the will of man, but of God. John will elaborate on this in our text tonight from 1 John 3 and say, what manner of love? Out of this world love that this is, that's been bestowed on us, that we get to do this. We get to have the authority to call ourselves the children of God, the sons of God. We're so used to it that it's almost as if it doesn't impress us anymore. And that's sad. We're so used to saying we're the children of God, we're the sons of God. But maybe it's not sad. Maybe we're supposed to get used to it. But man, let's don't lose the wonder of it. Let's don't lose the wonder of I get to be one of his kids. And what would that mean if I truly comprehended what it got to mean to be one of his kids? I want to show you the message of this because I love the way Peterson writes this. The life light was the real thing. Every person entering life, he brings into light. He was in the world was there through him, and yet the world didn't even notice. He came to his own people, but they didn't want him. Whoever did want him, who believed he was who he claimed and would do what he said, he made to be their true selves, their child of God selves. They are God begotten, not blood begotten, not flesh begotten, not sex begotten, not naturally begotten sons of God. You don't get it through birthright or race or inheritance or creed or country or dogma or denomination or quotation or confessional prayer. It is not something that comes through the work of a flesh. It's something that comes through the act of the Spirit based upon our believing what he says about us. But I love how Peterson says he made them to be their true selves, because I could not agree more. What we are made for is to see ourselves in the image of God as made like Adam. Adam, pulled from the dust of the earth, breath of God breathed into him. That's us. You say, yes, but Adam fell. But we all fall. Your kids fall. Your kids don't act like you want them to act and do what you want them to do, and they don't cease to be your kids. What you really want them to do is figure out their true self. That's what you've been doing your entire existence as a mom or a dad, is trying to get your kid to know, here's what you are. Here's who you are. Guys, this is an out of this world love. This is the Father trying to get his creation to understand that it is not a master-slave relationship. It is a father-son relationship. That it is not God at the top of a ladder and you at the bottom of the ladder and God dropping down doggy treats going, get one more rung, I'll drop you another one. One more rung, I'll drop you another one. And you're doing everything you can, hand over fist, to try to make it home. No, it's Jesus at the bottom of that ladder in John 1 and angels ascending and descending upon Jesus. And where is Jesus? Standing right here with us going, heaven has come to you. Because when it's your kid, you run down the end of the road to meet them coming home. What you want them to see is their true selves. Our true selves, our true place is understanding who our Father is. What manner of love is this? What out of this world love that God would let me know he's my Father? Doesn't he know I don't deserve that? Doesn't he know I haven't earned that? Hasn't God been watching the way I've lived? Hasn't God listened to some of the stuff I've said? Has God seen what I've seen? It's out of this world that he would love you. Because by God, you know you and you're unlovable. I throw me in too many pronouns. It's time for me to use you once in a while. I'm always saying me and everybody just stares at me. So let me use you. You know you and you're unlovable. And sometimes you're filthy and you're wicked and you think thoughts contrary to not just to God, but to yourself and to people that love you. What manner of love would he keep loving you anyway? I mean, that would take an out of this world love. And now maybe we're starting to scratch a little bit of what John was trying to get his audience to know. He says, look, for as many as believed on him, he gave them the right to call themselves the sons of God. Now, I just want to pause right there for a moment. I want you to think about this phrase. He gave us the right to call ourselves the sons of God. He didn't make us into the children of God. He let us call ourselves the children of God. Okay? Well, you say, well, when did I become the children of God then? I ask you, when were you not? When Paul spoke to the Athenians about the statue to the unknown God, remember, from the book of Acts, and he said to a bunch of idol-worshipping, Greek God-fearing, heathen, non-Jewish, non-Jesus-believing group of scholars, and Paul said to them, in him we live, and we move, and we breathe, and we have our being. And we are all not very far away from him. And he called all of them children of God. He said, all of us, children of God. His children. He has sent Jesus for his children. Listen, I don't think there's a person on the earth that doesn't belong as one of the children of God. It's seeing Jesus and receiving the life of the Father that Jesus gives that gives you the authority to call yourself one of the sons of God. Because without seeing Jesus, you'll never understand the right and the authority that you have to call yourself one of the sons of God. You'll just keep trying to climb that ladder to please God. In other words, without Jesus, we'll never see him as Father. We'll just keep seeing him as God. And the love that he has for his children is out of this world. You wonder why we always end up, I think, in theological debates over who's in, who's out, who gets it, who doesn't get it, who's loved, who's not loved. I think because we're arguing about an out of this world love and we're trying to box it in through definitions that are in this world. We're trying to take an out of this world love and we're trying to understand it through our own ideas and our own doctrines and our own theologies and our own understandings. And what we want to do with that is every time we get to that point, we stop and say, well, is this what you're saying? Is this what you're saying about people? And is everyone saved? Is everyone going to heaven? We always jump as far out as we can theologically, and we leave the love of God behind, and we start trying to land in places no one has the authority to land. Like, for instance, I don't have the authority to land on the other side of the cosmic Jordan. Like, I don't know what happens to everybody when they take their last breath and their heart stops beating. The gospel is not presenting people with what happens when you take your last breath and your heart stops beating. The gospel is good news. The king has come and you get to be a citizen of his kingdom. And if you'll accept who he is and his authority and make him that Lord in your life, then you'll begin to live the life of God on this earth. Now what happens after that? Not even the apostle Paul knew. He goes to be absent from the body, present with the Lord. Don't really know what that looks like. We'll leave that in his hands. And yet, when we start talking about the love of God, we all run off to heaven and hell, saved and lost. And we always want to know who gets to go into what camp. Is that what you're saying about the love of God? Why do we do this with love? Why do we categorize love through terms that no, through the a lens of definition that has more to do with the eternal than it does with what's going on right now? I think it's because it's actually easier for us to put people into boxes of whether they're worth our time or not based on where we think they're going. And if it isn't about where you're going and it's just about being who you could be in him, then we got to deal with people. And man, that ain't near as fun to just deal with people, because people have problems and people have issues and people have stuff. And you mean I got to love them in spite of all of that? What manner of love is this that he has bestowed upon us? I love it that you cannot pin down the love of God. I love it because it means you haven't went far enough yet. It means there's a really good chance that when you think you've come to the end, you probably haven't come to the end, because it's what manner of love is this? This is out of this world. I haven't seen a love like this. I don't want to get home someday, because when I leave this body, I'm going to be in his presence. I got an amen out of that. I'll take it. I know that my spirit goes to where he is. My flesh can go back to dirt. That can go back to dirt. My spirit goes to be with him. That's all. That's good enough for me. All right. When I get there, it'll be a joyous moment. Be exciting. I do not want my Lord Jesus with his nail-scarred hand to put his arm around my shoulder and say, "Son, why'd you make my love so small?" But I'm quite positive that no matter what I say to you, I will not get home and him put his arm around my shoulder and say, "Son, that was ridiculous. Why'd you make my love so big?" I've had that thought on my mind for about 2 weeks. To go, I'm not going to get there. I'm going to do what I can to not get home and him say, "Why'd you make my love so little, son?" Because I'm positive I can't overdo it. Now you think about that for a little bit. Maybe I'm wrong. I just have a hard time imagining this scenario. "Son, welcome home. Boy, you really overdid it with the love stuff. I mean, son, ain't nobody can love as big as you made my father out to love. There's no way that he could love as deep as you made his love. Son, why did you have my father's love so wide?" See, it just sounds silly, doesn't it? It just seems impossible to me. So I know I'm making up a fantastical scenario. I know it doesn't exist that way. Or I don't know, maybe it does. But I've had that in my mind. And all that really does is get me to land here, is to say, I haven't yet comprehended the height, the width, the depth, and the length of the love of God, and I'm going to keep trying. And the second I think I found it will be the moment I know I haven't. And then we get to push a little more. Why? Because it's out of this world, man. What manner of love is this that people who had an image of God, that he's their master and they're his slave, now get to call him their daddy, and they get to call themselves his kids. And they have the right to do that. That's out of this world. That's an out-of-this-world love. That's incredible. 1 John 1:3. "That which we have seen and we have heard, we declare to you." Did I give you 1:3? I meant 3:1. That's my fault. Let's go back. It's back. It's our source verse. And I even went over this with you and I still miss this. "Behold what manner," here we go. "Behold what manner of love the Father has bestowed on us, that we should be called children of God." Now, here's our next sentence. "Therefore the world does not know us, because it did not know him." Let me say it this way. Next screen. "Do not expect to be understood by the systems of this world." Why? "Because the love you give to others should be," quote unquote, "out of this world. And hard to comprehend by systems of power. Your love will be hard to comprehend by systems of reciprocity, by systems of authority," because that's the way the world works. Through the systems of strength and might, through the systems of reciprocity, which is you get what you deserve. You do that to him, he's going to do that to you. You do that to me, I do that to you. If we bring the love that's out of this world into that system, the world's not going to understand that. I think one of the great tragedies, I didn't put this on the screen because I kind of wrestled with it, but I'm going to try to work it out just a little bit with you. I think one of the great tragedies is whenever we see the world appearing to have more compassion and love for people than the church does. That has got to be the darkest moment that the church can walk through. Is when we look and see the systems of this world thinking about people more than the church is. If the church is thinking about influence and power and authority over people, how can we not say we're not the first church of the Pharisee? Because the issue with the Pharisees was not morality. The issue with the Pharisees was not right living. Nobody was outliving them. Nobody had higher morals than them. It wasn't Bible memorization and scripture adherence and church attendance and giving. What was the problem? People. People. Loving people got in the way of living for God. That was the Pharisees' great failure. Loving people got in the way. People get in the way because people are dirty. And some of them are publicans and prostitutes and murderers and Gentiles and Romans, and they're in the way. And don't these people know that there's a price to pay? And here comes Jesus loving all of them. And it infuriates the establishment. And they're not mad at the things we often think that they're angry at. What they're upset about is that Jesus has replaced all of the formulas with loving people. Loving people trumps all the stuff. Man, and the scary thing is, how many times has loving people become a policy issue instead of a church issue? It's supposed to be our game, man. Loving people's our game. We're the ones that think about the outcast and the downtrodden and the poor and the hurting and the marginalized. We're the ones that pull people up, that tell them it can be better, that give them hope. We're the ones. That's our stuff. Nobody else gets to have that. And they're not supposed to understand our love. It's not supposed to be the other way around. They're not going to understand you, he said, because they didn't understand Jesus. What's that say to me? Whatever they didn't understand about Jesus is what they're not going to understand about us. What did they not understand about Jesus? How's he spending so much time with people who aren't worth it? Who can't give him anything? They can't build his ministry. They're dirty in the sense of morality. Why does he spend time with them? Because they didn't understand Jesus. They won't understand you. God help us in the Church of America to be misunderstood for all the right reasons by the world. As they go, that church is a place of love and compassion. Let me show you what that love looks like. I won't stay here all night, but I just want to give you that. Everybody knows this. But man, sometimes we just use this in weddings only. And that is sad. We reuse 1 Corinthians 13. We go, here's what you're supposed to do with your spouse. Okay, I want you to don't think about this as a wedding chapter or something you're going to hear at the next ceremony you go to. Start to think of this as the definitions of love. And when you've tried to put God's love in a box and qualify it with 15 questions, take the questions, throw them out the window, and let this stuff right here be the qualifier, because this is as good as it gets. This is as close as we get to an out-of-this-world love. 1 Corinthians 13:1. I can speak with the tongues of men and of angels, but if I don't love, then I'm a sounding brass and I'm a clanking cymbal. So I can give scripture and stories and humor and theology and wisdom and intelligence, but if I don't love people, he goes, it's really just a waste of time. And man, a lot of us in ministry have spent a lot of time honing the sound of our voice at the expense of honing the amount of our love. And that's a tragedy that we've had to work through. That when I say we, let me just say me, that I've had to work through. Is to go, it's not enough to know God's words. You need to know God's heart. And that's what Paul, I think, was running into. Is to go, I can have the right words, but if I don't love people, sounding brass, tinkling cymbal. Verse 2. Though I have the gift of prophecy, I could understand mysteries, I could understand all knowledge, and though I have all faith, I could even remove mountains, but if I don't love, I'm nothing. Verse 3. And though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, and I give my body to be burned, but I have love, it profits me nothing. So it's not just the doing. It's the love behind the doing. It's not just I donated to this or I was a part of that cause. Paul doesn't even let us off the hook there. It's not like, well, you can go fake it till you make it. No, there's a love behind what I do. He goes, if not, then profits me nothing. Verse 4. This is where it gets tough. Love suffers long. Love's kind. Love doesn't envy. Love doesn't parade itself. Love doesn't puff up. Love doesn't behave rudely. Love doesn't seek its own. Love isn't provoked. Love doesn't think evil. Love doesn't rejoice in iniquity. Love rejoices in the truth. We could be there all night. I mean, that's out of this world, man. I don't love like this. On my best day, I might knock two of these out. I mean, maybe three if I'm just really lucky. But this is a love. I don't think I can possibly be accused of making his love too big, because I'm not even getting close to this. This is an incredible. Verse 7. Look at this. Bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never fails. You go, hey, how big is God's love? You mean, what about this? Does God's love go over here? Does God's love go over there? What about this question? What about that question? Here's all I know. Bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. You can't outstretch it, outrun it, outjump it. The love of God is out of this world. It's bigger than I can put into words. It never fails. If there's prophecies, that's going to fail. If there's tongues, that's going to cease. If there's knowledge, that's going to vanish away. We could keep going, but you get the gist of it. I think Paul, he's frustrated with the Corinthian church. There's no doubt. If you read the Corinthian letter, they got problems, man. They got lots of them. And he gets to the 13th chapter and he goes, you want to know the biggest thing we need to do, church? I've been jumping you for suing each other and sleeping with temple prostitutes and getting drunk on communion wine. All of that's in 1 Corinthians before you ever get to chapter 13. Then he gets to chapter 13. He goes, you want to know the biggest thing we need? Man, guys, we just love people. Just love them and don't qualify them. Love beyond your abilities. I know it's impossible for all of us. That's why John calls it an out of this world love. Now, what do we do with it? We embrace it. 1 John 3:2. Beloved, now we are children of God and it has not yet been revealed what we shall be, but we know that when he is revealed, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. Let me discuss this just briefly before I give a qualifying text with this. You can look at this as an eschatological verse if you'd like. And you can say, John's talking about the moment when Jesus appears in front of them. And we can slot that in as a judicial appearing of Jesus at AD 70. I don't think the fullness of this verse is met with an AD 70 interpretation. Because I don't think the fullness of this verse is met with an eschatological interpretation. I think the fullness of this verse is something John brings out in vivid detail in his gospel. Okay, so think about the verse that's there. We're children, but we don't know everything we shall be. We will, when he's revealed, we're going to be like him because we're going to see him as he is. Look at that line. This line has caused us to make this physical. We're going to see him as he is. We see Jesus in the physical. And yet, Jesus was confronted by that very thought in John 14:19. And listen to how he dealt with it. A little while longer and the world will not see me, but you will see me. Look at this. In a little while, people out there are not going to see me. You're going to see me. Because I live, you're going to live. And in that day, you're going to know I'm in the Father and you're in me and I'm in you. Now you go, what's that mean? Good question. Watch what this guy asked. Verse 20. We'll keep going. He who has my commandments and keeps them is he who loves me. He who loves me, beloved by my Father, I love him, manifest myself to him. Look at that phrase. Manifest. We're going to come back to that. Next screen. Judas, not Iscariot, said to him, watch this question. Lord, how is it that you will manifest yourself to us and not to the world? That's a great question. How is it that we're going to be able to see you, but they're not going to be able to see you because I don't understand how we can see you, they can't see you. What are you talking about? This is a mystery. And Jesus says, if anyone loves me, he will keep my word. My Father will love him. We will come to him and make our home with him. Brian, go back one screen. Look at this verse we flew through. He who has my commandments and keeps them, that's the guy that loves me. The guy that loves me will be loved by my Father. Watch this. I will love him and manifest myself to him. Jesus is making a promise. There is a place where you and I live in communion to where I manifest, I reveal myself to you. That prompts 22. That prompts this next question. How are we going to be able to see and they're not? Here's how. Because if anyone loves me, he'll keep my word. My Father will love him. We will come to him and make our home with him. And what gets missed here, and we did this when we did John 14, but what gets missed here is the word home is the Greek word mone, used only two times in the Bible. This is the second time, and the first time was earlier in the chapter when Jesus said this, let not your heart be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many mansions, mones, homes. I'm going to go prepare a place for you. I'm going to come receive you to myself. Fast forward, verses 19 and 20. I'm going to go to a place where they can't see me, but you can. Hey, Jesus. Yes, Judas, not Iscariot. Hey, Jesus. How's that going to happen that I'm going to be able to see, but they're not going to be able to see? He goes, remember that thing I told you a few verses ago about Monet? In my Father's house are many mansions. Man, we got messed up in the English translation. If they had just made this word right here, mansions, that would have changed our theology. Because it's the same word. In my Father's house are many mansions. Where is that mansion? We're going to come and make our mansion in you. So what's the manifestation of Jesus to you? It's when you allow the Father to take up residence in your heart and He manifests who He is in you. And as that happens, you get the blessing of seeing who He is. Go back to 1 John 3:3. Was our next, is that our next passage? Everyone who has this hope in Him purifies himself just as He is pure. Can you give me verse 2 again? I know I'm out of order there, but I really want to show you this, the verse. It was earlier in the run. 1 John 3:2. Your children of God, it's not yet been revealed what we shall be, but we know that when He is revealed. Yes, Judas, not Iscariot. I can reveal myself to you, but not to them. What would it mean if I did that? It would mean that my Father and I have made a mansion inside of you. And when we make a mansion inside of you, you'll be able to see who the Father really is and who the Son really is. And guess what else? You're going to be like Him because you're going to see Him the way He really is. Don't push this out into eschatological past or future. Put this as a present possession for everyone who knows they're the sons of God. And you go, I know I'm one of His kids because He's made His mansion in me. And He's happy to live in here. And because He's happy to live in here, He's revealing to me who He is. And when He reveals to me who He is, He's revealing to me who I am. And man, that's an out of this world kind of love. And that's me starting to walk in and rest in it. Now give me 3:3. Brian, you're good at what you do. 1 John 3:3. Everyone who has this hope in Him purifies himself just as He is pure. And I want to land right here. Next screen. You are as pure as He is pure. If He's the righteousness of God, you are the righteousness of God. You are not trying to be pure. You are pure. Therefore, live with Christ as a model, not as a goal. Let Christ be your model for how to navigate this earth. He's not your goal. You're not trying to live up to Him. He's already happy in here. His house is right here, man. His house is right there. His house is right there. His house is right there. His temple is right here. You're already pure as He is pure. So use Him as a model for how to walk it out, how to live it out. Now be careful. Only in this. You don't have to be scared, but be careful. When you go read the Gospels, hold on tightly, because He's going to show you how to love your enemies. He's going to show you how to treat people around you. And it is not lollipops and rainbows. It never is when you get smitten on the cheek and you're asked to turn the other one. You've stepped into the real arena now. The other way is easy. The other way, you just respond by your emotions and do what the system does. But when you watch Jesus as your model, there's going to be many times in your life you go, Father, I know You're at home in me. What would You have me to do? Because my emotions tell me to do one thing, but I'm watching Jesus as my model, and my Jesus does another thing. And that's what I want to follow, is my Jesus. Not to live up to, but to live from what He says about me. Can you give me verse 1 more time? 1 John 3:1. I'm going to end where I started. Behold, what manner of love the Father has bestowed on us, that we should be called the children of God. There's one more thing I didn't give you that's important, and this is it. This is our final thought. Right after that exclamation point, there are no exclamation points in the Greek, no question marks, no quote marks in the Greek, all right? These are added by translators trying to bring the punch. One of the reasons why your English translators added an exclamation point here is because there was debate among translators and scholars for centuries as to whether the sentence ended here. It's almost been solved because the oldest Greek manuscript we have found of 1 John chapter 3, verse 1 says, right after the word God, says, and we are. And one of the reasons why they put that exclamation point is because there was an emphaticness in the Greek. And so it reads a little more like this. Behold, the love of the Father is out of this world. So out of this world that we would be called the children of God, because we are the children of God. So I leave you with this thought. His love is out of this world because He calls you the children of God. And He doesn't call you the children of God for any other reason but this. Because we are the children of God. And that's good news. Father, thank You once again for good news. Thank You for the power of the Word and the excitement of it. And I hope in our way we have somehow helped one more person sort of crest that hill, that roller coaster. Not because we're trying to ride emotional roller coasters, but just to see the panoramic view in front of us of the love of the Father. Sometimes it just is of such great benefit to see it through new eyes and a new lens. So help us with the height and the width and the depth and the length. Help us to see that the love is out of this world. In Jesus' name, amen.